Well, so far, the Arctic has not been boring for me. No, it's exciting every time. I mean, there are just fantastic scenes. The Arctic reveals itself in new ways all the time. And so, it's kind of a long relationship, right? Where you continually are exposed to new aspects of personality.
The Ice Pod is the podcast about polar science and the people.
We talked to scientists who went on board Polarstern, the German research icebreaker, for the biggest research expedition in the Arctic. Hello and welcome to The Ice Pod, the podcast for the Year of Polar Prediction
and the podcast about polar science and the people.
My name is Kirstin Werner.
And I'm Sara Pasqualetto.
And we both work in the International Coordination Office for Polar Prediction at the Alfred Wegener Institute in Bremerhaven. Also, Sara, we have to tell our audience something today, which we haven't mentioned any earlier.
That's right. So, well, everything eventually comes to an ending. And for the most part, we hope this is a happy ending.
Yes, because Mosaic already came to an end. And so today we are recording the final episode of the iSpot, at least the final episode of the iSpot season one in support of the Mosaic Ice Drift. And our happy ending today is the co-lead of Mosaic, Matthew Shoup. Hello, Matt. Or better, early good morning to Colorado, Matt. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's great. We found a date and you found the time very early. As I said, it's 7 a.m. in Colorado. And Matt, before we actually start talking to you about Mosaic, I just wanted to introduce you a bit. So you studied at the University of Puget Sound, which is in Washington State, close by Seattle. And later on, you did your PhD in Colorado, in Boulder already, right? We were wondering about, were you born and raised in Washington State or?
So I was actually born in Washington, D.C., which is on the east coast of the U.S., of course. And then eventually, I did college in Washington State, which is on the west coast. And I lived at multiple places in between on my way towards college.
Okay. And what made you then go? Because I was wondering, I looked up where Puget Sound is because I never heard of it before. It's close to the Pacific Ocean. And then I was wondering, with all the waterways there, what made you go to the hot and dry Colorado eventually?
Yeah. First off, the Puget Sound is beautiful. It's the northwest of the U.S. and it's very green and very lush and lots of moisture and rain. And it's just a fantastic place. And that was really an attraction for me when I was going to college. But yeah, then making it out to Colorado, why there? So that was kind of opportunistic. Through my college studies, I built an instrument and I got an opportunity to go to the Arctic on a field program to the Arctic. And I operated my instrument there and I met some people there from Boulder, Colorado. And that gave me an opportunity to get a job. And so that was my first job going to Boulder. And that project in the Arctic was actually called SHIBA. And it was actually really important in my career path and the whole kind of design of Mosaic. So actually it all fits together really nicely.
And you know, the listeners, you might want to go back to the episode with Tanil Ota, who was actually Matt's boss by the time and took him to the SHIBA expedition. And she also talked a little bit about it. So Matt Shoup is now a senior research scientist at the CIRES Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Science at the University of Colorado and NOAA. Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah, that's correct. So it's what's called a joint institute. And so I have a kind of a dual affiliation with the university and with NOAA. And NOAA is a federal lab in the United States that deals with things like weather forecasting and weather prediction. And so it's a really nice joint kind of institute between these two so that we could do research and we can support our kind of weather forecasting in the U.S. on both sides.
Yeah. And so, Matt, I was wondering, did you know that there's a Wikipedia entry about you?
I did not know this, no. Maybe I should look that up and see what kind of information is on there.
It's even more interesting than that, I would say, because it's in German only.
Exactly. It's pretty solid information, but the Wikipedia article is in German only. So.
Wow. Okay, I wonder who put that there.
So our assumption is that the Mosaic people put it there. Together with, there's also Wikipedia entry for Marcus Rex. And for whom else, Sarah? You looked it up? Klaus Detloff, maybe?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So probably someone from the Mosaic team did that for the German public, maybe, who's interested in the people who are working for Mosaic. So we found that very interesting, actually. And I also found in that Wikipedia article, and we can come to that maybe later also, but you were the first one, so that was mentioned there, you were the first one who found liquid water in clouds. First of all, is it true? And then second, I'm really wondering. So the explanation was liquid water in clouds that are clouds with temperatures below zero, so apparently, you would think they would freeze, but then because they don't have any condensation nucleus, they cannot freeze. But I would just think the water would fall out of the clouds as rain or something. So how is that even possible?
Yeah, so we're jumping right into some hardcore science. Which is great. So these are mixed phase clouds. That's the kind of name for them. And that they're mixed phase because they have liquid water and ice water together in the same cloud at temperatures that are below the freezing point, right? So that's the basic concept. And I did not discover those, no. I mean, people had seen those before, of course, and they happen all around the world. It just turns out that they happen a lot in the Arctic, right? Because the Arctic is very cold, and the Arctic is also very clean. So there's not those little particles, the aerosols in the atmosphere. There's not as many of those to glaciate the cloud, right? To turn the liquid water into ice. And so that and a number of other processes kind of come together to make it so that these clouds occur a lot in the Arctic. And that was where I really started my career. And I did a lot of work on that. And I, you know, people certainly knew about these clouds before the work that I did, of course. But I just did a lot of research into that to really understand kind of, you know, over longer term data sets to understand how prevalent these clouds were, what their overall effect on the system was in terms of their radiative impact. And now we know they're actually really important for the Arctic system. And so I did a lot of that early work.
Can I picture this mixed clouds, mixed phase clouds as like slush ice then, or?
Not really. They are liquid water and ice crystals that are kind of separate from each other. They're in the same volumes, but they are individual particles. And so you can imagine there's lots of liquid droplets. It's a liquid cloud, like an overcast dark cloud that you get a lot in northern Germany, right? It's those kind of really dark clouds. They still look the same. And then every once in a while, one of those liquid droplets turns into an ice crystal. And then it grows really rapidly because ice grows faster than liquid water at those temperatures. And then those ice crystals get big and then they fall out. And that's one of the really key pieces of these clouds is that the ice crystals, when they grow, they steal all the moisture, but they get so big and they fall out. So they're no longer there to steal the moisture. And so the liquid water drops can kind of still hang out in the clouds and persist for a long period of time. Just because there's so few of those events, there's so few events when the liquid drops turn to ice and they fall out.
And I looked at your publication list, and I would say about 95% of your publication titles include the word cloud. I didn't count them all, but I started, but then I thought, okay, it's too much. So when did it really start with you? Looking at the clouds, was that already when you were, you know, a kid, always being in the clouds somehow, or?
Not really. It was mostly in my undergraduate college. And I told you that I built an instrument there, and that was with my advisor and with another student. And we built this passive infrared instrument that looked out the window and looked up at the clouds. And we were measuring the infrared radiation from clouds. And it told us something about the properties of clouds. And that's really when I started to become interested in clouds and cloud properties and how they affect radiation. So it was really kind of inspiration from an advisor that I had at college.
Very interesting. So maybe we go directly into the first song. You know, you sent us some music, and I was really thinking, oh, that's so different from the other playlist we had so far. The Grateful Dead was a band. I got a CD when I was a kid from a person who visited us from the US, and I have never heard of them, but I really like them. So I think it's not very popular in Germany, but then I found that early when I was a kid. So I really like that you brought that up. And I think the first song is Fire on the Mountains. Is a live 2008 remaster.
I really like live music, and you know, the Grateful Dead's a really classic band in the U.S. They were playing for about 30 years from the mid 60s until the mid 90s, and yeah, it's really all about the live music. That's the fantastic part about them. And they actually did play live in Germany a handful of times. There's a couple of classic shows back in the 70s.
I see. Okay,
you should check it out.
Yeah.
We are back to the iSpot, the podcast about polar science and the people. This is probably not the last time we will say it, but the last time we will say it for this season. So we are back with Matt Shoup. We are connected with him from Colorado, and we are going into the heart of our conversation. So Matt Shoup, as we said earlier, is the co-lead of Mosaic. And in this section of our interview, we wanted to discuss a little bit more about the project, about your role as co-lead, and also maybe how the project came about. So the first question I have for you is, how did you get involved at all on Mosaic, starting from the very first meeting that you attended that was discussing about a possible project, a possible one-year drift on the Arctic?
Yeah, so I will say that there's multiple paths that came together. I've been working on Mosaic since 2008, where I was on an icebreaker near the North Pole. This was on the Odin, the Swedish icebreaker. And we were there studying many of the same processes, and we were already leaving. It was so quick that we were leaving, and we just weren't there long enough. And I didn't understand where the sea ice had come from and where it was going. And to me, it was just too short of a time. And so at that point, I had been to Sheba, which was also a year in the Arctic ice, and I'd been on a number of other opportunities in the Arctic. So I'd done a lot of Arctic research, and it was really striking me that we needed to go back to the Arctic for at least a year, and ideally it was going to be multiple years. And so I started working on this concept for this interdisciplinary project that would have us there in the Arctic for at least a year, ideally more. And then, you know, let's see, it was 2011 was the first time that we actually had a meeting. And that's where I met Klaus Detlef, and Klaus had some similar ideas. You know, he had a workshop that was called AIDA. It was some kind of, I forget what it stands for. And so we, at that point, started having some serious discussions about, hey, our ideas sound pretty similar. We have some really interesting overlap here. And we started kind of converging these together, because we both had lots of people that were interested. And so at that point, we really started kind of blending ideas and engaging more of the international community in those ideas and kind of expanding from there. And so bringing lots of people into the bigger picture to kind of design the science plan and all the rest of that.
So both of you, Klaus Detlef, who was the former leader, the German leader of Mosaic, and you had basically the same idea. And then you went on a conference and figured, okay,
do this.
Maybe we can put this together. Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say the ideas were not the same. They had some similarities, but then that's where it got really interesting, I think, because that's where the community came together. And we had to decide, you know, what are the priorities, right? What in fact, are the most important things that we need to study out there together? And so that's where, yeah, I thought it got really exciting, because we could see all the different perspectives from all these different, international groups. And, you know, IASC, the International Arctic Science Committee, was very much involved. And so that brought a very nice international community. And so, yeah, it really expanded from there, all the different perspectives and contributions.
You were also mentioning before, and as we said, we also talked about Shiba with this was also another big international project with Tanil Utta on episode 6. If you haven't heard it, you should go back and have listened to our chat with Tanil. And both Shiba and Mosaic are those kind of projects that you know are going to talked about for a long time and are going to, like, data collected there are going to be used for a long time and kind of put some milestone into the, well, in this case, polar science and polar prediction for us more closely. So if you could, like, I don't know, come up with a list of ingredients that you would need to put this projects together, what would they be? What would you really need to come up with the project and with a plan like Shiba or Mosaic in this case?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. And I'll just say right away that Shiba was definitely a model for Mosaic. There were so many details from Shiba that went into kind of my initial thinking about how do you build a Mosaic? What kinds of parts do you have, right? So having the experience, I think, is really important, right? You build on this. And so many other sources contributed, right? The Russian drifting stations or, you know, these other projects that various people went to in the Arctic have all contributed in their own ways to constructing Mosaic and making Mosaic the greatest expedition that we could make, right? And so I think that's part of it, is you have to have some experience, right? You have to build on the past. That's a key part. You also have to have, at this point, you have to have international buy-in, right? Shiba was largely a U.S. effort. It was also Canadian, and there was a few other contributions. But one thing that I think makes Mosaic really great is that there were so many different nations involved, right? We really brought expertise from all around the world to contribute. And to me, you kind of need to have that these days, right? The questions and the science that's happening in the Arctic, those are international questions, and those are ones that we all have a big stake in, a big interest in. And so to me, that really was important. And then also you need to have some champions, right? You need to have people that are willing to go through the hard times of it all. And I'd say that's really where Klaus and where myself came in, right? We worked really hard over many years when there was no funding or there was very little funding. And there was, in many cases, people say, oh, no way, that's not going to happen, right? I know, for example, within Avi, you know, Klaus worked really hard to convince the leadership there that this is something that we should do. And I know it was very frustrating at times for him. And same on the international scene, right? We had to get all this support. Or I know myself here in the U.S., I was talking to funding agencies. And, you know, you go home sometimes after those and just be really depressed because, wow, they're not really buying into this idea. But eventually, over time, you keep working, right? And that's where the champions really come in. You put a lot of effort into it. You keep working. And eventually, you can pull together a critical mass of people that say, this is a great idea. And then eventually gets to the point where, hey, there's enough people that have bought into this idea. And then, of course, when Avi put the Polar Stern on the table and said, okay, now that's a really big event. And that really, changes things. But so there you go. I think that you have to have some experience. You have to have this international group. And you have to have some champions that are really willing to you know, put their careers on the line and really work hard to make it happen.
How did NSF like the idea to work so closely with the Germans and Polarstern?
I can't speak for them specifically. All I can say is that there are certain things that are difficult, you know, international collaboration, figuring out how funds can go every which way, right? That's a hard part. And I know that there were times when that was challenging. And also, you know, NSF often is, you know, I won't say in charge, but they're often the lead agency on a lot of projects. And so now they were taking, a secondary role, which I think probably took a little bit of work from them. On the other hand, I think that it's really fantastic. And this is my opinion here, not necessarily NSF's opinion, but it's really fantastic when there is a lead agency like Avi, who is able to put so much structure to things, right? They organized so many different aspects. And so when you can, as a funding agency, invest in something like that, it's really nice to have, you know, have somebody that's so well organized that can kind of be the lead institution.
Matt, I'm also curious about the first moment you met Markus Rex. When did that happen and how? Maybe we have to explain. So the Klaus Detloff was the one who had the idea at AVI Research Unit Potsdam. And then Marcus Rex took over eventually. I don't know what year that was.
I don't remember either exactly. I do know that Klaus was basically at retirement age, and I know that there was, you know, he was in this kind of staged process of retiring, and they needed to replace him as the head of that unit. And I know that there was a job available. I know a number of people that applied for that job.
Okay.
Some people asked me to apply for that job.
Yeah.
I did not want to apply for that job myself.
Would have been hard to be the US and the German lead all together.
That would have been extremely hard. And, you know, thank goodness Marcus was there. I think Marcus has been, you know, he's worked very hard. I think he's a great spokesman. You know, he really interacts on the international stage very well. And so I'm trying to remember the first time I met him, though. I don't actually recall. I do recall some early times. Yeah, but I don't remember the moment. It was at some meeting, and certainly Klaus was there as well.
And you were mentioning, I mean, and we know a little bit that it took a long time to plan this expedition and this and the project and to put everything together, so to say. So maybe what we were curious to know what's a little bit more about your role over the years. So what were your tasks, maybe as a champion, as you were saying, and as a co-lead in the end, and also maybe what was the hardest part that you had to cope with along the years. You were mentioning, of course, at the beginning, skepticism and maybe a harder time putting people and interests together, but maybe, yeah, also from a organizational point of view, what was the hardest side for you?
I'll start with the second part first. The hardest parts were certainly the skepticism and getting kind of, you know, not turned down, but kind of, yeah, getting negative energies from people about the possible path forward. That was hard, but also it was hard to, I think, to get people in the mindset of what it takes to be in the Central Arctic for a year. I think that most people involved had some kind of experience of the Arctic, but very few people actually have the experience of this continuous year, especially in the winter time, right? And that's where we could talk and talk and talk about, hey, what it's like in the winter, but people just didn't understand it because they hadn't really lived it. And so it turned out that that was a big challenge for a lot of us because we weren't necessarily fully prepared for what this year would all entail. But I think that's part of the normal process, but that was a challenging piece. As to my role along the way, I would say I definitely was most focused on the science, right? That's, you know, the early part was really focused on designing the science, bringing together, you know, a team of experts to say, how do we put this together? And for me, you know, one of the key ingredients from the very beginning was the interdisciplinary part. We had to have all these different parts together because that's the Arctic system. You can't study, you know, just my atmosphere part, my clouds. I can't go out there and do that by itself because that doesn't make sense, right? It only works if you study it together with the sea ice, with the ocean, with the biology, the chemistry, all these different parts working together because that's the Arctic system and that's what's changing. And so to me, my role was really in helping to design that science and helping to bring the right people to the table to talk about how the coupled system science pieces fit together. And then what do we need to measure? How do we measure that? And that was, you know, I was constantly a champion for that and constantly a cheerleader for that, like bringing people to the table to talk about how we design the science.
Here's my question, Matt. I'm a geologist, and I was wondering a bit why geology did not play a big role in this Mosaic expedition.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, because there are so many disciplines, right? And many of those kinds of questions have come up, like where are the boundaries, right? How do you define what is part of this project and what's not? And the simple answer, I think, is climate relevance. You know, we're in the middle of this transitioning Arctic, right? The sea ice is melting. There's all these kind of changes that are happening pretty rapidly in the Arctic right now. And we're really interested in processes that are all bound to that kind of transition, right? So, of course, things like sea ice physics is really important there. And the atmospheric drivers of change or responses to change, or how is the ecosystem changing right here and now? And how is that feeding back on the climate system change itself? A lot of geology is playing out over much longer timescales, right? Geologic timescales are much longer. So I would say, I mean, of course there are links, but I would say that a lot of the geologic processes are not necessarily the ones that are driving this specific change that's happening in our climate system right now. So that was kind of how we define the boundaries, is what processes are directly linked to these climate changes that we're seeing in the Arctic system, both, and this goes right to the heart of Mosaic in the science question that drives us. What are the causes and consequences of this evolving and diminished Arctic sea ice cover? Right? That's our central science question. And so what things are contributing to that change in sea ice and what things are responding to those at a process level? That's kind of the boundaries of the science that we dealt with Mosaic.
Before we move to the next music, I have one last, another question. As you were saying, there are a lot of elements, components that came together and with this interdisciplinary approach, and all these pieces of this mosaic came together, and there were a lot of expectations also probably from the different areas and the scientists involved. So along the years, what was your greatest expectation about Mosaic and what you would like to achieve ultimately?
Oh, well, the great expectations. Well,
yeah.
This is the title for this podcast episode, The Great Expectations.
First off, I will say, and this is, of course, a challenge for me as a human, but to try to moderate expectations is really important, right? Especially with field work, mm-hmm. because field work almost never turns out as you plan it, right? I've been in the field many, many times.
Right.
And, you know, you can go there with great expectations, but, you know, the system tends to give you what it gives you. And Mosaic was no different, right? The Arctic came up and said, hey, this is what I am right now, right? I am a dynamic ice pack, and I'm going to push you across the Arctic way faster than you thought you were going to go across the Arctic, and I'm going to break up.
Yes. Yes. True.
You know, at some level, my expectations were not necessarily the plan of the Arctic, right? You know, I expected that we would be with the same ice flow continuously for a whole year, and that didn't turn out to be the case, right? And so at some level, I had to let those expectations go and be open to the kind of a new set of opportunities. And that's really what happened is we had this opportunity for really fantastic science, but we had to be flexible to adapt to that, to adapt to what the Arctic would throw at us. And I think we did a great job given some really challenging conditions. And, you know, COVID as well, right? Of course, right? The whole world was different at this time. And so we really had to adapt our expectations to this evolving system. And I think we did a great job with that.
I think you did a great job too. Yeah, despite everything, I mean, if everything could go wrong in like planning at logistics, at least in relations to the pandemic and etc., I think, you know, everything worked for the best, and whatever was planned, I think one way or another came to be. I think so. Yeah, we have been really, you know, almost on the edge of our seats to see how things would evolve during this year, and it was really exciting to watch as well. So now we can have another piece of music to hear. And we have Yonder Mountain String Band, Half Moon Rising. That was really exciting when I was putting the playlist together. I really like this. Do you have a special connection to this song?
Well, I mean, this is just a popular song from Yonder Mountain String Band. And a lot of the members from Yonder Mountain String Band live in the mountains around where I live here.
Oh, yoo-hoo.
Certainly a nationally touring, you know, a very nationally popular band in the U.S., but they, you know, some of the members come from my kind of local area here.
Okay, let's hear it then.
I'm looking forward to listen to Matt's playlist in the car. We are now moving into fieldwork. Matt, and you said you were joining leg one and leg four. So you have been there when it started, basically. So you were on Polarstern when going into the Arctic, and then you also joined leg four, and now you have to remind me, that was the summer leg, which was supposed to arrive by plane but couldn't because of COVID, and then finally arrived by Merian and Sonne, yeah?
That is correct.
You had to go to Germany to enter those German research vessels, Maria S. Merian and Sonne, and those brought you then close to the sea ice edge, I think.
Yeah, up near Svalbard, yes.
Yeah, while Polarstern left the camp, packed most of the stuff, they left something and went to pick up the people and bring the Leg 3 team to the sea ice edge, and then you had a nice exchange there.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so which of the two legs did you prefer? Or, yeah.
Wow!
Did you like more?
I prefer them both. They were both truly fantastic. And, you know, one great aspect of them, there were many great aspects, but one was that, you know, Leg 1 was mostly in the dark and Leg 4 was mostly in the light. And these were kind of polar opposites. And, you know, the Arctic is so fantastic. And so one aspect is how the sun behaves, right? And so having the polar night is really important. And being there, you know, it had been many years since I'd been in the polar night, so it was very nice. But then also, yeah, the polar day and the summertime was also really tremendous time to be there. So, those two next to each other was really cool.
Yeah, I see. And you having a lot of experience now in the Arctic, are you getting still strong emotions when you arrive there? Or is it just, okay, that's another time in the Arctic?
Well, so far, the Arctic has not been boring for me. No, it's exciting every time. I mean, there are just fantastic scenes. The Arctic reveals itself in new ways all the time. And so, you know, it's kind of a long relationship, right? Where you continually are exposed to new aspects of personality.
As the co-lead of Mosaic, there are two different roles. There's one working on land to make sure everything works together with Markus, and then also on board and in the field. So maybe we start with being in the field. What was your task there? I remember you had a very interesting tool or instrument set up there, the atmospheric surface flux station. That was one of the things you did there, right?
Yeah, I actually have a lot of funded projects for Mosaic. So
okay.
I have a lot of out there. One of my instruments, if you will, you know, and I say my, but it's really our team, right? We have a whole team of people that have built these, is those ASFS systems. They're these for looking at surface energy budget and surface energy transfer, and they're little sleds, and they were installed in the Mosaic distributed network, at least initially, and then we had to move them around. And so they provided really nice perspective on the energy budget and energy transfer at the surface, which is one of the important goals for our project. And part of that, we also had a MET tower that was at MET City in the Central Observatory that had many of the same instruments. And so we basically had these different points.
So you had your team on board and you worked with them to set up the instruments and to run them. Was that the main task you had on board, or did you, how was the communication with Markus Rex going on?
We had very routine communication. We had lots of kind of leadership meetings. I was on the leadership team. Of course, we had a collection of different team leads there. And so we would meet fairly often, sometimes every day, to talk about the various issues that were coming up with the teams, to help to coordinate and plan. That, you know, like I said before, there was lots that we had to adapt where we, you know, we find the ice that's thinner than we had planned on. And so what does that mean for how we set up the camp? And so we had lots of dialogue about that. That part was really important, the kind of onboard meeting time and that kind of part. But I also viewed my role and one that I really embodied was on the ground. I think on the ground leadership was really important because that's, you know, the scientists are out there, they're on the ice, they're running into their own challenges. And I really wanted to be embedded in all that. So I really wanted to be engaged with people on the ground.
On the ground, you mean From land?
No, on the ice. I'm sorry. On the surface.
On the ice. On the ice ground. Okay, I see.
You can plan with meetings on board the ship, right? Mm-hmm. You have meetings. And there were many meetings, and meetings were very important. But for myself, I really wanted to be out there embedded in the work and doing the work, because I think that that's where you really see a lot of the challenges that are arising, and you identify the issues that need to be addressed. And this was, I think, so important because of a point that I brought up earlier, where we collectively as a group didn't have that much experience in the polar night, right? And for long-term projects, right? We just didn't have that much experience. And so understanding how things are going to evolve in the coming months, it really takes being there on the surface, embedded in it, to understand that, and then to kind of work through how do we adapt what we're doing to make it more sustainable. I mean, that's, to me, was a really important part. So, you know, we've got power lines out there, or we've got installations, and how can we ensure that those things are going to be the best they can be for many, many months into the future so that they can make the measurements that we want, right? And so that's where I really wanted to be out there on the surface and kind of engaged in as many different parts as I could so that I could really understand how that was all fitting together, both kind of operationally and scientifically.
How was the atmosphere on board? I mean, many, many of the, you know, people speak German, you know, the crew is usually communicating in German. I mean, they speak English, I know. But so how did that work out? Was that all good for you, or did you sometimes feel, okay, my few words in German help me?
I do have a little background in German, yeah. So that I'm not great at speaking German, but I can hear it pretty well. So that was actually, I viewed that as a great opportunity. And it was a little funny at times, right? Because I can understand some, but not everything. And so some people knew that. So, you know, like the captains or whatever we'd kind of have some funny things going on because they would like to speak in German and they knew that I could understand some of it, but not all of it. And so that became a funny thing at times. And that was great. And I think that, everybody, it was really fantastic on board. You know, there was lots of different nations there, lots of different people, and they all bring their own languages and their own experiences and their own perspectives and their own science. But somehow we all were able to speak kind of the same language at some level, right? And I don't even know what exactly it was, but we were there as a tribe, as a family working together. And so to me, that part felt really amazing. We just really identified together somehow. And to me, that cohesion really helped us to kind of push through the challenging times and work really hard together.
How did that atmosphere evolve? What do you think? What is the, you know, the ingredient to get such a family atmosphere on board?
Part of it is that you go through shared experiences, right? So over time, it develops even further. And so by the end of a leg, right, by the end of leg one, we were just a team. And when that next team came, they were the outsiders, right? It didn't matter if they came from my same country or not. They were the outsiders and we were our team, right? So you develop this camaraderie that's really amazing. But I think also, and this is something that I really focused on a lot, was everybody has value there, right? Everybody is contributing. Everybody is in this extreme environment. It's very hard to operate. And every little piece actually matters. And so I really wanted to make sure that I would get around to the different people and really acknowledge that, like, your work matters here. And I think that that helps to build this team where everybody feels like they do play a part. They do play an important part in what we're trying to create together. And so that kind of attitude is something that I was really trying to push as much as possible. And so I think it helped at some level for everybody to feel included and part of the bigger kind of process that was playing out.
Yeah, I think this is a great point, really appreciating everyone's work and really being interested in what everyone's doing and asking and involving. Yeah, that's true. Matt, I was also wondering, because you have this experience from US and Canadian icebreakers, what is the biggest difference between this German icebreaker Polarstern and the US ones, for example, or the Canadian?
I haven't been on US ones very much, a little bit, but the US icebreakers are military. Right, they're Coast Guard,
okay,
a military entity. So that's, the attitude is a little different there. It's a bunch of, you know, generally young,
mm-hmm.
you know, very young sailors.
Yeah.
So that's a different thing, right? So being on more on the civilian side is very nice. And that's how the Canadian icebreakers are as well. Civilian sailors and civilian crew. And so the a little different attitude there, a little more laid back on the German and Canadian sides on the icebreakers. Also, I think, I would say that, U.S. icebreakers are pretty metal, right? They're cold steel, whereas, you know, European icebreakers have nice wood paneling and things like this, where it's just
cozy,
a little more relaxed, I would say.
Yeah.
And that, I think, also comes from the kind of military versus civilian kind of side of things as well. So, yeah, I really liked on Polar Stern how, there's nice and there's cozy spaces that were relaxed that, you could feel. Yeah, boy, like the Blue Saloon on board is just a great place to go. It was usually very quiet, but just a place that just felt like a nice place to relax.
How did you spend your spare time once you got back from the ice? What did you do?
Are you saying my spare time on board?
Yeah. Or wasn't there any?
Yeah, first off, I'll say there was very little of that, especially on leg one. It would be very long days on the ice. And like I said before, I it was really important for me to spend time out on the ice. And so I would spend really long days out there. And then coming back on board, there was inevitably lots of meetings to talk with people. And then data. I was involved in numerous projects there, both the ones I described with the flux stations, but also the single largest project on board is from the Department of Energy from the U.S. They had a huge facility on board with many containers and tons of instruments. And I was also the PI for that, that whole project. And so there was a lot of data from lots of instruments that I needed to look at to say, hey, does this make sense? Do some analysis to or at least kind of initial analysis to make sure that we're making the measurements that we think we're making. And so I would do that at night. And so there was very little, I would say, relaxation time. Now on leg four, I tried to do a little more of that. And so we actually, there was a group of us that played this Italian card game, and that was really fun. And so we would do that on occasion.
What card game is that? Maybe Sarah knows because she's from Italy.
I'm curious. Yeah.
Briscola?
Briscola. Oh my God. Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. It was fantastic. I mean, there was an Italian guy on board and he had the cards. And of course, the Italian cards are different than the cards we have in the US. And so there were just, interesting features on them. And we had this nice little collection of people that were, Briscola, it's just a fantastic game. It really is a fantastic game with all kinds of strategy and you work together in teams and things like this. And so we had this collection of people and it was really funny, right? For me, it was just this great relaxation because it was a card game and strategies, right? So your brain still works. My brain doesn't really shut off that much. But then it was also really fun and just kind of like to play with the personalities of different people as you were strategizing through the game. And so to me, that was a great bit of relaxation.
Also, it's fun because, you're technically not allowed, I think, but like you can develop signs with the other person to say what you're going to play, but like with the cards and everything.
Little kind of patterns and things that we would try to communicate with our partner, but not the others, even though they knew exactly what we're talking about. So it was that's where it was funny, right? That's where it was relaxing and funny because it was this personality that was playing out as well. It
right.
was more than just the game. And it was really funny. We had a number of Italians on board. And so in our core group, there was one Italian that taught us and we played. But then the other Italians occasionally would kind of come by and be like, oh, and then they could hop right in and play the game because they knew the game, right? And so that was actually really fun as well.
Sounds as if, Sarah, you have to show me that card game at some point. When we are allowed again.
Well, we would need at least two other people to play with. So
okay, yeah. I see.
But it's fun. You would love it.
Yeah, we actually did. We played all kinds. We played three people, five people, four people's best, I think. But we played all kinds of different, for sure.
I was also wondering, Matt, so when you were not out in the field. So for like 2, 3, and 5, how did your work look like from, you know, working from home then with Polarstern?
Yeah, it was Mosaic all the time. I mean, I tried to, you know, I've got a lot of other things going on as well, and I tried to focus on those somewhat, but, you know, Mosaic really has meant a lot to me for many years, and I wasn't going to kind of walk away from it at any point. So there was lots of work to do. And, you know, especially I'll say on leg three, right? So leg three was the leg that got extended by a couple months longer because of the coronavirus. And that was a really important time for Mosaic, right? There were some people on board that were having a hard time being isolated out there for longer than expected in the middle of a pandemic, not quite sure what's happening in the rest of the world. You know, how about our family back home thing, right? So it's a really stressful time. And it was also a time when, you know, the logistics were starting to change to, you know, some things couldn't happen anymore because of travel restrictions. And I know that, you know, the Avi logistics were working really hard to try to come up with options. And there were so many dead ends that were not working out. And so it was just a really stressful time for so many people. And, you know, at that point, the morale was a big deal for me. You know, how people feel about being there, right? I just wanted Mosaic to be something that was awesome for people, right? That was just like pumped them up and they were excited to be there. And when I started to hear that some people were not excited to be there, that was really unfortunate. It was something that I really started to work a lot on. And so I would spend pretty much every day interacting with people. I mean, like, certainly everybody that was from the US out there, I definitely communicated with. Also, I was, you know, I'm an atmosphere team coordinator. So I was really trying to interact directly with every individual out there that I could to figure out where they were coming from so that we could really figure out the kind of onboard morale, because the morale, it seemed to me, was kind of getting negative and negative. And then that kind of draws more people into a negative space, right? And to me, that was something that was, we needed to turn that around.
How did you turn around?
Well, the big part was we needed to listen to what concerns people had, right? What was making them feel really concerned? And so some of it was, hey, we started getting more news to them, right? They wanted more information. What's happening in the world, right? We know there's this coronavirus thing, but we don't know enough information. And so you can imagine that you might start to feel a little nervous being out there, right? So we needed to get them more information. And some of that information, you know, I tried to get people very specific information. I knew where some people were from. And so you could give them information about their local area. Like, hey, here's what the coronavirus is looking like in your area. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Trying to get people more information. And then people wanted more information about how are we getting home. And this is really hard because, you know, the Avi logistics side is working on a plan, right? They're working very hard to come up with a plan and facing all these dead ends. Mm-hmm. At some point, you know, it was really clear that the people just needed more information. They needed to know that somebody was working on it, because they felt like a thing that I kept hearing is that they were like, well, nobody cares about us. Nobody's even working on this. And that, of course, was not true, right? Of course, people were working very hard. And so then it was more like, okay, how can we communicate information to people to say, in fact, we're trying so hard and here's the multiple plans that we're working on right now. And once we could start to communicate those things, then I think people started to feel like, you know, actually people do care about us and they are actually trying really hard to come up with a plan, right? And I think that helps the morale a lot, right? To know that somebody cares. And so just little things like that, like figuring out what people needed. And so those are the kind of things that I would think about a lot, is how can we make Mosaic work better?
Okay, I think we're moving to the next song. Theory Corporation, Until the Morning.
Mention it always at the beginning, sometimes in the middle, that the iSpot is the official podcast of the Year of Polar Prediction, and MetShoop happened to be involved in the Year of Polar Prediction. So and of course, I mean, we are doing this podcast and we're following Mosaic because of its incredible relevance also for the Year of Polar Prediction and the Polar Prediction project in general. So maybe this is the time where we can dig a little bit more into what actually Mosaic means for YOP and for the polar prediction community in general. So maybe you could Matt, you could tell us more about what the system was set up and what really like some key measurements that you would say, oh yeah, this is so yob somehow. This is something that screams polar prediction.
One of the key things about Mosaic is that it was designed from the beginning to really play to the needs of the modeling community, right? We can't just go out there and observe things just to observe them, right? We actually need to have a purpose, and we know that we need to funnel this knowledge into models, right? So that was kind of a basic thing. And so to know then that, hey, there's the polar prediction project and there's YOP and there's all these activities going on was actually a really natural partnership, of course, right? Because there's this whole community of international modelers that want this information. And so, you know, of course, you know, there's a partnership there. And so that really, I think that the interaction with the Polar Prediction Project really helped to contribute a lot to the design of Mosaic from the very beginning. So one aspect that was important there is our distributed network, right? So it's one thing to go out there and make, you know, put one ship out and have one point measurement. And most of the modeling community kind of laughs at that a little bit, right? Because models are global or they're regional or they're very extensive. And so one point is some information and it's great and it's process information, but we really need to have a little more understanding spatially of what's happening, right? Because a model has to represent what's called a grid cell, right? Some kind of spatial domain. That's the resolution of the model. And what's happening within that domain is what's called sub-grid scale processes. And what's happening larger is resolved by the model. And so we need to understand what's happening within those grid domains. What's the variability within that? It's not just one number, but it's actually some distribution of numbers that we have to represent. And so that's one thing that we tried to design then the Mosaic distributed network to have multiple points across the domain that looks kind of like a model grid box. And really, we also tried to design the spacing of that based on the physics that plays out, right? There's a certain spacing that you might want within the sea ice versus in the atmosphere versus in the ocean that would kind of represent the variability of the processes playing out. And we tried to do the best we could to kind of find the happy middle ground there to understand the kind of key variability in processes. And so the notion then is that you know, all these different points of measurements across some domain can give us the kind of information that we might find useful then to represent some of the processes that are happening within a model grid cell. And so, you know, from very early on, that aspect of Mosaic was one of the things that was most appealing to the polar prediction community, because it will help to provide that kind of link and kind of scaling of information.
You have spent a year there collecting lots of data, an incredible amount of kind of unique data set, because, you know, we talked about data from Polar Night, which is normally not, there's not a lot of information on what's going on there, and people are normally not there to collect observation during Polar Night. And so there is a lot that can be done, right? What do you think it's the next step now? I mean, it's somehow the expedition is over, but it's also not, in a way. I mean, the work starts kind of now for this modeling community, at least, and the polar prediction community that works with the data itself.
Yeah. So for the specifically relevant for the polar prediction community, the step now is to really integrate a lot of this information. And so we're working very hard to get the data, right, the Mosaic data, into a state that's useful for models. And so we have a team of people working to create these data products that are matched very nicely with model output that's along the drift path of Polar Stern, so that we can then match these data in space and time to then have a fantastic observational data set that can be used to evaluate the processes in the models. And so to me, that's what's going to play out in the coming years, is let's make sure we have really solid data packaged in the right way, and then let's actually do kind of process level evaluation of the models. And I think this is really an exciting aspect, because, you know, most of the models, You know, they are largely atmospheric models. That's a big part of it, right? And more we're getting models that are coupled system models that are engaging other aspects. And so I think here, again, is an opportunity to really continue to push the edge of those model capabilities. You know, how can we evaluate coupled system processes within models and really help to push models to do a better job of representing those coupled processes? And by coupled processes, I basically mean the different modules of a model. So you have an atmosphere in the model, you have sea ice in the model, you have an ocean in the model, and these things are all interacting. Maybe there's a flux of energy that goes between those of heat or momentum or something like this. And all those processes are, in my mind, those are the cutting edge, right? Those are the things that are the newest aspects of the models. And they're the ones that we need the most information about. We need to evaluate those processes so that we can continue to improve on how the models are coupled, how they're communicating across their different modules. And so to me, that's the really exciting opportunity here in the coming years, is to really focus on those kinds of topics.
Mm-hmm. And maybe for the listeners of the iSpot, so I just want to mention here, there's a project called YOP Sitemap. YOP, Supersite Model Intercomparison Project. For its long title, that is led by Swedish professor Gunilla Svensson. And this is really what tries to also now takes the mosaic data and makes it available for the modelers to use it and to then compare and see how actually the models perform. And I think you might hear more about this project in the years to come. Mosaic was one of the super sites for the year of polar prediction.
Right. Also, we talked about it with Gunilla on one of our bonus episodes.
Yes.
So if you're curious about it, you can go back and listen to bonus episode with Gunilla. This might be a slightly harder question. I hope it's not, but I don't know. Feel free to give your thoughts here. So we talk about YOP and YOP's legacy because in 2022, the year of polar prediction and the polar prediction project will officially be over, and it's carrying it along, a long history and a huge baggage of experiences and somehow activities that have been carried out, and of course Mosaic will be a huge part of this of this baggage. So if you could say maybe what after 2022, and in light of all this of all this work that has been done, what can be the next big thing? So what would be really something that can be done, and also what would be the way forward for all of this work that has been done?
Yeah, the next big thing. Everybody likes to talk about the next big thing, and
great expectations here, I would say.
So I would challenge us, though. I would challenge us as a community to use what we have, right? I mean, there will be a next great thing, and there will be many, you know, future expeditions and future programs, and I think that's great, and of course I will participate in those as well. But I would challenge us to use a lot of what we have, right? We have this amazing set of data from Mosaic and elsewhere, right? We have, one of the interesting things that comes up for me is this notion of, okay, now we've got this Mosaic data set, and how does that relate to what happened at Sheba or what happened to during the Russian drifting stations over so many decades? And what is this telling us about the innate aspects of the Arctic system versus those that are changing, and how do we put those together? And that really requires synthesis, and synthesis requires data over a long period of time, but it also requires models and a modeling perspective, because models help to pull together the big picture, right? And so this is an area where we can use observations and models together to advance our knowledge, to advance our understanding of the system. So it's not just advancing the model tools themselves, which is also important and will also happen, but it's advancing our kind of system level knowledge and understanding. And that's something that it really will take a concerted effort to pull all this information that we have, right? There's so much that has not been analyzed yet that we could pull in and really synthesize. And so to me, I'd say that's a challenge for us as a community, and it's for us as individual scientists, but it's also for us as funding institutions to say it's actually important invest in harvesting this knowledge that we've been building up. It's always easy, I'd say easy, right, to get a new fancy thing funded, right? Let's go do something new. But it's maybe less, some ways less sexy to fund the old stuff. But I still think that we can really gain so much from that synthesis. And so that's what I'd like to see is us as an Arctic research community really push for some kind of big synthesis. It's like, where are we now with all this information that we've collected over these last decades? Where are we now? And what does that tell us about the future? So to me, I'd like to see that.
Matt, I was also wondering, you are also very interested in outreach and communication. And I found, I hope this is true, you led an NSF-funded project on communication and outreach for Mosaic, right?
Yeah, so I told you at the beginning here that I had many different projects. And I had, one of those was funded by the National Science Foundation in the U.S. To do a lot of coordination work, so a lot of the coordination work from the U.S. side, but also a lot of communication. And I think that communication is so important. I spoke earlier about the importance of every different person that was out there, right? And we had communicators. And to me, they are just as much, just as important as the scientists and the technicians and the crew and like all these different pieces, right? The communicators are people that can help to convey this message. And I think that you all right here, right? We're having this ice pod. It's such an important role because it allows us to have this dialogue between scientists who are often very stuck in this very detailed world that's really important world, but how can we make that relevant for a broader audience? And so that's one of the aspects of that project.
Yeah, I'm really happy to hear that, actually. And I was wondering, in your perspective, what is most important when it comes to communicating climate change and changes in the Arctic to the public? I mean, it's challenging. You have the polar bear, but then, sometimes it gets really hard to really tell people, okay, something is changing here. We have to do something about it.
Yeah, I agree that it's very hard. And part of the reason it's hard is because people don't have a personal experience there, right? Most people will never go to the Arctic. They will never see the Arctic. And so it's like, out of sight, out of mind, right? It's not part of anybody's normal life. And so, it doesn't really matter that much if the ice is melting over there a long ways away, right? So that's where I think that the imagery, right? We've had some fantastic photographers and videographers out there in the field that can bring back content that can help to immerse an audience into what it's like to be out there. Right. So to me, that's a really important point. You have to have people that somehow resonate with the Arctic, right? They somehow feel like it matters because they have an understanding of what it is a little bit. And they can tap into a little bit of the excitement and the wonder of the Arctic. And so to me, that's one important part. And another is just to be able to convey messages and, what are the changes we're seeing there? How does that play out? How does that affect the rest of the globe? How does that affect our weather? How does that affect the ecosystem and our fisheries and other aspects? And the polar bear, of course, as well, right? How does it affect all these different... But that's where it really takes professionals, I think. Working together with scientists, I think scientists can also be communicators, right? But I think it does... Nice to have a few professionals involved that can facilitate that process of bringing some of these messages from the field, putting them in a form that is more accessible to a broad audience. So that's something that I really appreciate about the communicators that we've had involved so far.
Yeah. And they really did a great job, I have to say. We just saw the German version of this documentation that was just on German TV. And I really hope I heard there might be an English version as well. And this is something I was, my mother was really excited. She put some WhatsApp status pictures on that evening. Actually, also my yoga teacher asked me about it. So many different people who never otherwise hear something about the Arctic, they watched that movie and it had a great, effect on people.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's so compelling. The footage from the field just allows somebody to go there, right? To virtually go there and to see what it's like and to maybe start to understand what an interesting system it is and maybe what a fragile system it is. And you know, maybe to start to learn, you know, why is the Arctic important for the rest of us and the rest of the globe? And so, yeah, I that documentary is a fantastic example.
Yeah. So, if you haven't watched it, you might go. I think it's still on German TV Mediathek. We can put a link maybe there under the podcast description if it's available. And then also we hope for the English version pretty soon.
In the meantime, you can train your German skills.
Yeah. I have seen a little bit of that documentary. I need to see the whole thing. I would like to see the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's really, I mean, it's so well done. The video content is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I really look forward to seeing the whole thing.
I think there's also more work to be done over the years to communicating the mosaic outcome and maybe even connect that to people who have been in the field.
Maybe season 2 and 3 of the IcePod.
Yeah, let's see. Anyway, I think we have to move on with the next song, Sarah,
yes,
huh?
Yes, and we have a great classic now, and it's a personal favorite of mine, and it's an Immigrant Song by the Led Zeppelin.
Matt, looking now, I mean, now Mosaic is over, or the field work is over. Mosaic has not ended, we have to say that, because there's so much data and analysis to come. So what is, I mean, you said it already, I think, wrapping up the entire expedition. I mean, it was, you know, we had the pandemic and we were not expecting the ice moving so fast and disintegrating. But anyway, you said it already. So we have a great data set of observations and we can now use them to put them into coupled modeling, work on the models. So in summary, I mean, it all turned out very well. Not as expected, but you're happy. Are you?
I am happy. I'm happy for multiple reasons. I'm happy because we did get this really fantastic data set. That's really unlike any other data set in the past. So I'm happy about that. It's going to enable a lot of great science. I'm also happy because it's done.
Yeah.
At least the field part, right? I mean, this has been such a lot of work over many years. And so I'm kind of happy to have arrived at the end of that part of work and to transition into this analysis part, right? I mean, I'm a scientist. I like science. I like to look at numbers and make plots. And for the last decade, I have had to slow down my science quite a bit, right? In order to focus on making Mosaic happen, in order to focus on developing the science for Mosaic and, you know, pulling together different international partners and all these different aspects, right? So it's been a lot of work to do that over the last 10 years. And while that has been gratifying in its own way, it's not the same as actually doing a lot of the science. And I kind of miss that focus. And so I look forward to kind of turning my attention more to the analysis and to what, you know, what great mysteries are going to be kind of opened up and revealed here within the data and what can we, how can we advance our understanding? You know, I have so many questions myself that I've in my head that I'd like to try to address with the data. And so it'll be nice to be able to spend some time doing that.
Yeah, I guess you have already peeked a little bit into what you have on the observations, at least for your atmospheric surface flux station, maybe, or the Met Tower. Did you see, I mean, I know you cannot really talk about any, you know, things you want to eventually publish or so, but did you see something spectacular or something that comes as a surprise for you?
At various levels, right? There's lots mm-hmm. of things that are playing out and the data is really fantastic. I'll start with aerosols.
These are the little particles in the air, right?
Yeah, we had this great facility out there from the DOE ARM program that measured aerosols continuously with lots of different properties. And there were other partners measuring aerosols as well. And there were time periods when there were basically no aerosols in the atmosphere at all. Where were they? Things like that are really interesting. And
you know, we've seen some things kind of like that before, but to really understand the role of what are those kind of events, I mean, that'll be really fascinating for me. And then also, it's exciting to see that there are there's some hints about the kind of the sources and the processes that control the evolution of the number of those particles in the atmosphere. I think we're going to learn so much about that area. That's stuff that I'm personally interested in, but there's also many other people. So I think that we'll do a lot of great work there. From the cloud perspective, you know, this is my sweet spot of research for over many years. I saw a lot of my familiar clouds there, right? A lot of my mixed phase clouds, and it'll be great to look at those, to understand those. I mean, I haven't observed the clouds in that area as much as in, you know, I've mostly been over near Alaska and in that side of the Arctic. And so what are the similarities? That's going to be really important. Do clouds behave the same everywhere? Hey, maybe the answer is yes, and that will be an easy answer. But those are things we actually have to figure out and to kind of synthesize knowledge across those, you know, different locations. And then from the energy budget perspective, you know, it's really, you know, at the surface, there's all these different energetic transfer terms, right? That how heat is moved around the system. And maybe that's radiation from the atmosphere, or maybe that's the turbulent mixing. So the wind's blowing, temperature changes around, or there's a change of phase, right? So if you change between ice and the vapor phase, that converts heat. So there's all these different terms that convert heat at the surface. And we measured all of them together. And we measured at the same time all how the clouds vary and how the atmosphere varies. And so you can imagine starting to put together the puzzle. Like, because in the end, if you're interested in, hey, why is the sea ice melting? You'd probably want to know, how is the heat changing, right? How is this flux of heat changing in the system? It must be because the ice is melting. Yeah. And so you can start to put together the pieces of that puzzle. Like, okay, now we have the atmosphere. We understand the atmosphere drivers that affect the radiation, that affects the balance of heat and all the other terms on the surface. And hey, all those things depend on season. They all depend on how much snow is built up on the ice or how thick the ice is. And we can put together those pieces. And that's something that, you know, I've started to do now. And I really look forward to doing more of that in a holistic way so that we can understand this kind of changing Arctic system and how, from my perspective, how things like the atmosphere are forcing that and responding to that.
Coming a little bit more towards the end, we were wondering your strongest impressions, your biggest moments. Was there, you know, some important moment that maybe changed something in you also?
Oh, wow. well, you know, at some level, I'm changed all the time. I mean, I will always live with these experiences. And so many of them I will never forget. I mean, I think that for me, being there in the polar winter was really an important thing. You know, I had been polar winter at Sheba. And so going back there, that was really important. Just the fact that it's pitch black all day long. And to really be there experiencing the kind of blizzard, the it's snowing, mm-hmm. It's blowing all around, the snow is kind of flowing over the surface. That, I mean, to be in the middle of that actually matters for the analysis. And so to me, you know, I look so much at data, right? As scientists, we spend a lot of time at our desks looking at data, and I know what the data looks like, and I know how to interpret it really well. But in the end, you have to relate it to something that actually happens, you know, right, in the real world. And so being there in the field, it really is irreplaceable to know what that actually looks like, how that, you know, this data, what it actually looks like when it manifests in the field. And so that polar nighttime, it's just such a fantastic space to be in and to experience and so to understand what the data really means there in those kind of conditions. So that was really fantastic. And then, you know, this cracking of the ice, right? I mean, the ice cracks all the time. It's always cracked. But it seems like it cracked a little more this year than maybe it does in the past. And it was really cool to be embedded in that process, right? Right when we're setting up Met City, right in the first week we're on the ice flow. You know, I've got my Met Tower. It's kind of laid out on the ground. We're setting it up. And then I'm standing there actually talking to some of the people from the documentary. They were doing some filming there. Mm-hmm. We were just sitting there talking, and we heard this sound and felt a little rumble. And then, you know, I looked down and a crack happened right between my feet, right as we're standing there talking, and things like that, to be right and just embedded in the middle of this emerging Arctic system and to feel it right at this kind of like core level, to feel that those processes playing out. Well, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you have to be there to experience, and you're never going to forget it. Right. I'm always going to hold those kind of feelings of the system. So that's the kind of stuff that I bring home with me.
I think we have one final question for you, Sarah. You want to go ahead?
Yes. So we have this running question that we asked all of our guests, I think, at least the one that have been on Mosaic. And it all started with the big, I don't know, controversial choice. So we need to know from everybody. And it's related to this Mosaic jacket. So we wanted to ask you first, if you have one.
Yes.
You do?
Good.
And now that, that we know that, which team did you pick? If you pick one at all, because we know there is a neutral version as well.
Yeah, I have the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Team Jack.
Yay. We sort of guessed.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I'm one of the co-coordinators of the atmosphere team. And so, yeah, I figured that was the right one to have, although I would love to have one for all of them. The neutral one, actually, so there's the little mosaic kind of logo-y thing, and the neutral one is just white there, whereas the different teams have your different component highlighted with a color, and I would like one that had all of the components highlighted with colors, because I think that all, you know, all the teams are important, of course, and they all work together, and you know, I don't necessarily understand all the details of all the teams, but I really tried to learn a lot of the details and to interact and to understand their priorities, their science, how that fits together. And so, yeah, to me, that's the beauty of Mosaic, is how all those pieces do fit together. And these jackets actually are really great. Just a little anecdotal story. I was in the supermarket this past week.
Okay.
And somebody was reading off the back of my jacket, because I was wearing that jacket, and they were making some comment about the Arctic. I think I didn't pay attention initially, and then they said something a little louder to try to catch my attention. And then I said, yeah, you know, I was just in the Arctic. And then this person said, oh, you mean that ship that was frozen in out there or whatever? And these people knew about it, and
cool.
You know, the U.S. is a really big place, yeah. Right? So news,
right.
The news density is lower here as far as like the number of people I would expect to hear about that. But this has actually happened a number of times where people have somehow recognized me and said, you know, hey, you're related to this thing I heard about on the news or on the radio or on the whatever. And so that's, that's always great to know that there actually is a lot of people,
yeah,
there out there that actually are exposed to this.
I think that might have something to do with your great job as a communicator with that National Science Foundation project, maybe, to have done the good work spreading the word in the US.
Mosaic in pop culture. That would be great.
Yeah.
Just a comment now that we are towards the end of the episode, but also towards the end of the season. So, I mean, we've learned a lot. And I think in a way, also my approach to Mosaic and the expedition itself was always just that it's a given, you know, it's happening now. And everybody is so pumped up about it. And everybody is so excited and is following it. And I think like the most striking thing that I learned today, at least, is just that it wasn't always a given. And it wasn't always like, you know, set in stone and taken for granted, so to say, that it takes a lot of work to promote this kind of things and to push for things to happen. So I guess that's a nice take-home message for me, at least, that, you know, these big projects don't, you know, are not born this way. They're not born big project necessarily. They need people, champions, teams, and knowledge to to happen and to grow and to become in the end what we follow and what we get excited about. That was really cool.
Yeah, that's so important. And you know, so this is where, you know, Klaus, myself, many others, I've worked really hard over many, many years. And it does take some big effort. You know, my personal thanks to all the people that have contributed so much effort over those years. It's also really interesting on the board of the Tereshnikov coming back from leg four. We were sitting there, we would have little discussion sessions, and we were sitting out on the deck. And, you know, a lot of the early career scientists said, what do we do next? You know, everybody's brains are spinning. Hey, we got to go back to the field. We got to go and do more science. And it was, so we actually had a discussion about, hey, what did we learn from this about what we do next time? And what do we do next? What are the priorities? And it was really cool for a lot of early career people to be talking about what would be next. And one of the messages I gave to them is exactly what you're saying, is it takes people, it takes the champions, it takes people working really hard to make something like that happen, but that anybody can really do it, right? It just takes persistence. And I basically, you know, challenged the people that were there. I said, you know, the next one is on you, right? You guys are the leaders for the next one. And it's going to take, maybe it takes 10 years to manifest, but you got to put in that effort, and band together and work with others. And so it's, to me, it's really great to see that, to see all the early career people that have been involved in Mosaic, and to know that the future of Arctic research is in great hands, and that we're going to have this whole crop of new people that are pushing things forward, and that can actually be, they could be the next generation of people that put that investment of their personal time into making the next great steps happen.
Yeah. And I think There's so much enthusiasm at the moment among these people. So I think there will definitely something coming up eventually with your advice and Markus Rex's advice, I think, yes. And maybe you have the chance to attend this, whatever it is, field cruise once again, and give good hints, and maybe step back a little bit from, you know, having a stressful time on board.
I look forward to being in a support role.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And we are wishing you good luck, Matt, with analyzing the data now and working with your group, and also retire a little bit from this stressful time you had planning, preparing, and implementing all these things to make it actually happen. We are also looking forward to continue working with you for the Year of Polar Prediction. I think your input is very much appreciated. And I think with that, Sarah, we are at the end of the final episode.
Yeah, I'm kind of not prepared to, like, I don't know, maybe I should have come up with a line or so, but maybe not. Hopefully there will be other occasions to keep talking about, you know, polar prediction in another format. Who knows? We can think about maybe talking it with Matt with about maybe some post-mosaic research and exciting features. Who knows? So, yeah, it's been great, personally. I hope also for Matt now, but also for the listeners, has been a great episode and a great season to follow. It certainly has been for us, I think. We learned not only technical audio things, but also a lot of information about this great project and the people behind it, especially. That was the main purpose, right?
And we also thank the Alfred Wegener Institute and the communication department for supporting us. And also especially Radio Weser TV, which is the Northern German community radio station, in full support for us. If you want, you can also go there and listen to the full episode with music. If you hear us on Spotify, you find a playlist of Ahmed. We put this on Spotify. Yeah, and also you find more information about us and about the iSpot on Twitter at Polar Prediction and on Instagram at Polar Prediction. We have a website, polarprediction.net, and we have an email address, Sarah, right?
Yes, it's polarprediction@gmail.com. It would actually be great to receive some feedback about what you thought about this season, but also maybe some expectations about what could come next. We are very happy to hear ideas, inputs, and yeah, something that from people that actually listen to us.
So thank you very much, Matt. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking all the time and getting up so early. And see you hopefully at some point around, I would say. Latest, we are planning right now the Yop Final Conference or Yop Final Summit that will be in Montreal in May 2022. And we hope that we all can go back together, meet to have nice discussions in person again.
Yeah, that would be great. I look forward to that.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The iSpot is produced by the Year of Polar Prediction International Coordination Office.
With the technical support of Radio Weser TV.
As well as the support by the communication team of Mosaic and the Alfred Wegener Institute.
Editorial responsibility is with
Kirstin Werner and
Sara Pasqualetto.
Our theme music is composed by Kevin MacLeod, available on incompetech.com.
For any questions, please contact us at polarprediction@gmail.com.